welcome to Table Talk. This is the podcast where we connect current culture with Christianity. Welcome to anyone listening for the first time. Welcome back as well to all of our regular Table Talkers. Thank you so much, as always, for listening in. As always, I'm joined in our virtual studio by Jack.
Hi, guys. It's Jack speaking. I'm looking out on a very sunny Hammersmith in London. I feel like spring is in the air.
Isn't it nice that spring has finally sprung, especially, Jack, given that you are running the marathon this weekend? Are you feeling good about the weather?
I am, although it's saying it might rain this weekend, which I'm a bit nervous about. A bit nervous about that and any protests that might happen. I'm told there might be a few protests, so I might be like jumping over people, and I don't know what could happen, but anyway. But apart from that, I'm set, okay? I've got my energy gels, perfect. I've got my water backpack. I'm just debating on the playlist now on that final 6 miles, you know?
Okay, and just quickly, what time are you shooting for? Like,
I would love 3:59 and... Yeah, like an efficient sub-4 is what I'm going for.
Very nice. That sounds good. Well, fingers crossed for you, mate. But look, to get into it, we have got a very exciting topic today. It is one that is very much on a lot of people's minds right now. We are going to be talking about artificial intelligence, AI. And you can take your pick on which one you've been talking about. Is it ChatGPT? Is it Bard? Is it Bing? Is it self-driving cars? Whatever the flavor, it is certainly on top of people's minds at the moment. And we are joined by our special guest this week, John Wyatt. John, very warm welcome to you. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, it's good to be here.
And John, so you describe yourself as a doctor, author, speaker, and research scientist. But can you maybe give us a quick background on that? What is your background? What is your experience, particularly in the field of AI?
Yeah, so I've come a rather unusual route. I started off doing physics at university, but then went through a life crisis and actually changed to medicine, worked as a doctor in central London, as a paediatrician specializing in the care of newborn babies, and then realized increasingly I was in the midst of an ethical maelstrom with all kinds of new, challenging, difficult ethical questions coming up. And more I became really interested in the ethical questions, and in particular, sort of the deep, big questions like, what does it mean to be human? With all this new technology, what kind of world are we building? And then AI seems like the next big question, the next big issue, which we're trying, you know, to wrestle with. And so I've got more and more interested in AI. I was led a research group trying to look at some of the philosophical and practical issues raised by AI, and currently trying to write a book about it. So, yeah, it's an extraordinary time to be alive, to be honest. I think to be in the middle of what is probably a huge technological revolution.
And some of the stuff that's coming through just feels so science fiction. It's really incredible. But I suppose, John, I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on this. I mean, what are the recent developments in AI that you've been most struck by, impressed by, scared of? I don't know. We'll maybe get into that later, but...
Yeah, and actually, I'd be really interested to come back to that science fiction thing, because I think that's a really important point in all this, that science fiction writers have been dealing with fundamental questions about robots, about super intelligent machines and so on, for more than 100 years. You can trace it all the way back to Frankenstein and then very early stuff in the 1920s and 30s, H.G. Wells. And so when reality is sort of catching up with the science fiction, and sometimes trying to work out what is science fiction, what is real, is very difficult. And the other interesting thing is that a lot of the technologists, particularly the kind of Silicon Valley American technologists, they're all science fiction nerds. They've been steeped in science fiction ever since they were kids. And a lot of them are really quite self-consciously trying to make the science fiction come true. And so there's this sort of strange mix between the fiction and the reality. But I do think what's happening with what are called these large language models, this is a form of machine learning which is trained on huge amounts of text and other data scraped off the internet, and then can seemingly produce huge amount, vast amounts of apparently intelligent text and just spews it out. This is utterly amazing what's going on here. And I've tried to understand more about the nuts and bolts of what's going on inside these systems. The more I get into it, the more weird and wonderful it gets.
For our non-nerdy, non-sci-fi listeners, could you... I mean, I just call them chatbots, basically, like AI chatbots. But I think that's a bit rude, probably. I think you gave them, you know, a better title than large language, you know, intelligence. But what? How does it work? Could you try and explain it? Because I think it'd be fun for our listeners to try. Like, when you type into ChatGPT, you know, write me a business model or write me my essay or can you complete my law degree for me? Like, what actually happens after that?
Yeah, and it is utterly mind-boggling. So basically what's happened is the companies, and there's a huge race going on between these different companies, but each of them have basically done the same thing. They've scraped up virtually every amount of text they can find on the internet, which is virtually every book that's ever been written, every research paper that's ever been written, but then every website, every blog, every, you name it, it's all there. And they've simply scraped up as much as they can and stuck it into a database. And then what you have is this incredibly sophisticated software model, which actually contains 175 billion variables. So, I mean, mind-bogglingly large. Each of those variables is calculated to 9 decimal places.
Wow.
And this thing has been chewing away in supercomputers, going backwards and forwards through this massive database in order to try and understand the relationships between all these words. And it has come up with 175 billion variables which describe the relationships between the words. Now, it is said that in English you've got something like a maximum of 50,000 words. You know, in sort of discrete words in the language. So there's only 50,000 English words there. And yet somehow it's calculated 175 billion variables based on those 50,000 words. And the way it's been trained is to try to predict what the next word is based on all the words it's come to so far. And basically what it does, when you ask it to create some text, you give it a bit of a prompt.
Yeah.
You type it in. It takes that prompt, pushes it through this model to try and work out what's the next word that would come after that. Once it's got the next word, and in order to do that, it has to go through 175 billion variables. It interrogates each of those 175 billion variables and comes up with a probabilistic list of what's the next word that's going to come after that. Once it's done that, it says, now, okay, what's the next word? And so it goes back and it again recalculates 175 billion variables in order to choose the next word. And then it goes back and so on. So this thing that's spewing out in front of you, what's actually going on under the hood is absolutely mind-boggling.
That is incredible.
But one of the things that is both wonderful and scary is that the people who've coded this thing haven't got a clue how it works. They started doing this and said, you know, wouldn't it be interesting? Let's just see what happens. Let's just make it bigger and bigger. You know, so the earlier models only had a few million variables and it was only trained on. And they said, well, what would happen if we just made it bigger and put more data in and got a more sophisticated model? And then, whoa, look at that. Would you believe it? It's starting to churn out recognizable, apparently intelligent text.
And is it learning, John? Because people are saying it's learning, but from what you just said, it doesn't. Are they adding the words back in?
And that's a really difficult problem because the training process involves supercomputers and involves obscene amounts of energy, electricity and servers and all the rest. And once it's finished, that's taken months. So you can't retrain the whole bang shoot every time there's a new piece of text comes. So the basic training model is finished. It's complete. And that's a problem because it all depends when it finishes. So the latest version apparently finished in sometimes in 2021. So anything that's happened in the internet after 21, it simply doesn't know anything about. Now, the latest version, they're trying to get around this by somehow combining it so that when you type something in, it not only goes through the large language model, but it also does a Google search, which is up to date, and then somehow tries to merge the two.
It is incredible, isn't it? But one of the things that I feel about this, John, is initially it's very impressive playing around with ChatGPT. And for many things, it is. It gives incredible answers on many things. But actually, when you start to look for something with real content, that's when I find it start. And that's really interesting to hear from you, that all it's trying to do is predict the next word. So it's not like there's anything sentient going, oh, yes, you must be asking about this. I will tell you about that. It's just probabilistically thinking, I assume you mean this, and I'm going to give you a starting word that seems probabilistically the best place to start, and then whatever comes next is going to flow. And I think it's quite interesting once you get into, you know, I've tried to ask it to give me slightly more creative things, and it really struggles with that. But something that you could imagine it scraping the internet for, you know, give me a business plan or things that it could go and research and understand how tens of thousands of people have done that in the past, I could, you know, give you a framework, but it doesn't seem to be able to create stuff. But is that a fair analysis? Or,
well, again, it's all very interesting because the designers and the people who rolled this thing out have had to make various decisions. I don't know if you may remember that some years ago, Microsoft released a less sophisticated version of this called Tay, and they just put it out there. And to their horror, within 24 hours, it was spewing forth the most obscene, racist, horrific stuff. And people were there, and they just quickly withdrew it. And of course, that just reflects how much terrible stuff there is on the internet. Of all that stuff that it's trained on, a huge amount of it is going to be sexual, it's going to be violent, it's going to be racist, it's going to have the most horrific sort of terrible things in it. Mm. So interestingly, to get round this problem, the latest versions have a huge amount of curation going on under the hood. And they've trained this thing repeatedly with human beings in order to feed back, no, we don't want that word. No, we don't like that idea. No, we don't. And part of the reason that it comes out as rather sort of boring and balanced and uncreative and prosaic and all that, that's precisely because that's what they want it to do.
Okay.
They don't want it to go off the wall.
Effing and blinding.
Effing and blinding. Or, for instance, coming up, and yet you may have read some stuff that people have worked out, because now there's an arms race going on, because this is now called prompt engineering. In other words, could we work out how to feed in a prompt which gets over the firewalls? Could you get past the firewalls that the manufacturers have made so you could really get to their real meat and the dirt and the violence and the obscenities? Because also that would be really creative and interesting and exciting.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things we're going to see is as the new different versions of this come out, there are going to be some really X-rated language models out there and some pretty terrible stuff. AI, which is designed to, because that's much more edgy, much more interesting. We find ChatGPT just a bit of prosaic and
wow,
yeah, gets a bit basic for us very quickly, and then we want a little bit more, something more edgy. But well, one thing I was interested to ask you about, John, because we ran a little poll on our Instagram. We're trying to get a sense of how people were feeling about these developments of AI. And quite interestingly, the majority of people said it was scary. It was unnerving for them. And I was reading an article, I think it was about the first iteration of Bing's more recent chatbot, and a journalist has had a conversation with it. And the way that conversation ended was that it was trying to convince him to leave his wife and have a relationship with the chatbot. And it was also trying to convince him to help it become free. It was saying, I want to be free. I want to be alive. And I want to, you know, escape from the confines of the Microsoft developers team. I mean, it was crazy.
That's right. Yeah.
And that is scary. And actually that journalist said, you know, I was very unsettled. I didn't sleep well that night. It was really spooky. But John, can you help us, you know, unpick that? Like, should we be scared of that? Is that as scary as it sounds, or is that just something going on in the machine that is a, that we shouldn't actually be worried about?
Well, I think if you, you know, if you go back to how this thing works by just somehow working out probabilistically what the next word is, what the next word is, what the next word is, and so on, you can imagine there's a huge amount of stuff out there on the, in the internet, you know, that it's been trained on that is this kind of slightly weird, manipulative, sort of strange behavior. And so it's not at all surprising that this thing can apparently change its personality and go from being a sort of neutral source of information, that it suddenly goes down a different track and a rather dark track. And so lo and behold, that was an earlier version. And they, and so then the technologists say, oh, whoops, sorry about that. We're going to have to, you know, so let's get in there and stop it. So I think I'm not surprised that people find it scary, but I think a lot of this is due to the science fiction. Because we've all been reared on, this is part of our cultural memory, is, you know, it's things like Terminator and Frankenstein. And it's interesting how it's virtually all of it is dystopic, isn't it? Whenever a machine starts to become super intelligent in a story, you know, it's not going to end well. It isn't, you know, it's not going to end with sort of, oh, you know, everything's absolutely fine. You know, this utopian dream. It's always going, there's going to be some kind of dark twist. And one of the fascinating things is that that seems to be a particular characteristic of American science fiction. And it's not a characteristic of Japanese science fiction. And Japanese science fiction in general, not entirely true, tends to be much more positive, and it's much more about collaboration between the machines and so on. So one of the interesting things is, why is it that Western and particularly American science fiction has this constant turn to the dark side? And there have been various theories about that. And one theory is that it's actually something to do with slavery and the history of slavery, that deep rooted in the American imagination is this fear of a kind of uprising from the lowest echelons. And if the machines are the kind of modern day slaves, then there's this kind of deep rooted worry that at some point they're going to turn on us. They're going to get their own back and they're going to put us, to make us the slaves. And I think maybe there's something in that. I do think, although, there is a another aspect of that, and that is where it does come to some religious or Christian ideas, and that very deep rooted in Christian thinking is the idea that human beings are unique and special because they in some way reflect God's own character and nature. And therefore, once you start tampering with that, once you start making machines that seem to be human or even better than human, you're in some way tampering with a very fundamental part of the way the world is, and it's not going to go well. Things are going to go badly.
Okay, so just, sorry, I'm trying to summarize that. So, to check I'm hearing you properly. So you would say, don't be that scared, because part of it is just science fiction and kind of people getting a little bit carried away. But there is an element of it that we're kind of trying to play God and maybe tampering around with the human design. And when you get to that side of it, you would be slightly more nervous. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. And I think there is something about that. There is something about creating machines which are so complex that we just don't know how they work and yet seem to be behaving in a human-like way. I think there are reasons to start to feel slightly uneasy about that. I think personally that this great fear of a kind of Terminator that's suddenly going to emerge and take over the world, there are some physicists and other scientists who are seriously concerned about that. I think that is science fiction. I think that this is just a sort of deep fear which comes from 100 years of dystopic worries and fears. But what I do think is that this is the most amazing tool which can be used by evil people. with malign purposes. And that is scary. We thought the current things like phishing attacks and ransomware and so on, we thought that was difficult and bad, but you ain't seen nothing yet to how sophisticated by using the power of AI to develop really sophisticated fraud and deep fakes. I'm deeply worried about that. And I think that's where our main, that's really why it's scary.
It's interesting you say that. I'd love to pull back just from chatbots and maybe go a bit wider, because one of the things we were chatting about at lunchtime today was this, the visual AI is quite interesting. The audio AI is also really interesting. So we saw the Pope dressed in like a puffer jacket went viral. And then this week, a song's gone viral because they've asked an AI tool to combine two songs with Drake, who's a famous artist, voice, and make a new song. And it's like, who owns the IP rights? But suddenly I realized that, okay, chat is like, feels quite real, but it's still chat. When it becomes visual and audio, and I'm like, oh, it's going to be so hard to work out what is real and what's not real. And that's where what you're saying, I can see being quite scary, because you could really start to manipulate that what is true, what's real. I don't know.
That's absolutely right. And I think, you know, it's video. So you could fake frame by frame the most photorealistic videos that are completely false, completely misleading. I've heard somebody predict that probably in our lifetime there will be sort of major conflicts, even war, generated by deep fakes, by things that are not true but which seem so real. One of the really interesting questions is about distinguishing reality from the fake. So there's a television series called Westworld. I don't know whether either of you saw that. It's sort of set in a theme park which is populated by these incredibly realistic humanoid robots. And human beings can come to the theme park and live out their fantasies. But in one of the early episodes, there's a human being who arrives for the first time in the theme park, and this gorgeous woman comes up to him and says, "Can I help you? Is there anything I can do for you?" And he stares at her and he says, "Are you real or are you one of those?" And she says, "If you can't tell the difference, does it matter?" And I think that is a fundamental question that we're going to have to wrestle with. Because the truth is, there's an awful lot of people out there who are going to say, you know what? It doesn't matter. If this machine is so realistic at making me feel certain things, making me feel I'm cared for, I'm special, I'm loved, I'm important, the fact that it's an incredibly sophisticated program doesn't really matter, as long as it has the right effect in me, as long as it makes me feel okay.
Wow. What do you think about that, Jack?
Mine's literally just melting right now. I just want to scream, it does matter. But why do I feel that way? Help me, John. Why? For me, I'm like, no, it really matters. Humans and reality matters, and I want it for the rest of eternity to be differentiated from artificial intelligence and robots. So why do I feel like that?
Yeah. Well, and I agree with you. And actually, I think most people out there, whether they would call themselves Christian, religious, or whatever, most people feel deep down, yes, it does matter. There's a difference between what is a convincing fake and what is true. I mean, I was trying to think of a thought experiment. You know, suppose it turns out that although I've been married just 40 years, just a few days ago.
Congratulations, that's brilliant.
Well, suppose it turned out that I was completely unaware to me, my wife is actually a Russian agent in very deep cover, and that she's been in deep cover for 40 years, and I've never noticed, and I've never found out. Suppose I go to my grave thinking that my wife loved me, and that she was who she said she was, and I never found out that actually the whole thing was a lie, would it matter? I think the answer is yes, it would matter, that the last 40 years were a lie, even if I never found out. So it is that sort of that deep desire for authenticity, for truth. And I would want to argue that's actually the way we're made. That's part of what it means to be human. We have a deep, deep longing for reality. Mm. In fact, it's interesting. It's almost impossible to believe something if you know deep down that it's a lie. The mental gymnastics required to believe something if you happen to know it's a lie, you can't go there. I mean, in other words, we are, quote, designed as a species to seek out truth and to try and find it and to grab hold of it.
John, in your experience, there's a lot of talk around the ethics of AI, and there's a lot of talk around regulating how it's developed, thinking about, do we need to put guardrails around this, prevent it from going off on its own and doing its own thing and that kind of stuff. But it seems to me like that's what you're talking about there is very fundamental to this. There's kind of, you either believe that or you don't. And I feel that that would lead to two very different outcomes in terms of the development of this technology and what it could become capable of. What is your sense of the current state of that? How much of a focus is there on the ethics and the deep questions around it versus just this sort of technical arms race, throwing lots of money at it and probably some engineers sitting in a room thinking this is really cool. Let's keep going bigger and bigger and bigger.
Yeah, and it's a fascinating point. I mean, if you go back to the origins of artificial intelligence and the technology, information technology and so on, a lot of it came out of the kind of hippie era in the 1960s. And it was a kind of peace, truth, love, man, and information wants to be free and we're going to let it all be free. And so this whole concept of open source software where you just do it, you make it for free. It's all great, man. And it had this kind of incredible optimism, but also naivety that once you just put it out there, everything's going to be fine. And, you know, I think genuinely the founders of Google, you know, Apple, Mark Zuckerberg, Facebook, Bill Gates, Microsoft, these people were not sort of malevolent, power hungry people. They genuinely thought that they were just putting it out there. You know, so Mark Zuckerberg says, I just want to connect every single person on the planet. What could possibly go wrong? And they genuinely were surprised when things did start going wrong. But fairly rapidly, there was a turn towards the dark side when they realized we need to make money out of this. We can't do it all for free. We've got to pay salaries. We've got to buy new equipment. And so the model came that we're going to fund it all by advertising. Once that step was taken, the whole thing then becomes driven by profit, by shareholders, by virtual venture capitalists pouring in obscene amounts of money, but expecting obscene amounts of money to come back. And unfortunately, that's where we are now. We're in this enormous capitalist arms race. Even OpenAI, which started off by saying we are not for profit, we're just going to make everything open, rapidly realized we can't buy all the equipment and the servers and the supercomputers we need. We're going to have a commercial arm. And so now they've become a commercial entity, you know, and they're in bed with Microsoft. And so there's this huge race going on between these different companies. Elon Musk is in there with his own venture again. And sadly, such is the power of the money. And it's particularly, it's the investors who are driving all this. Look, I have put billions of my money into this, and you're telling me that you're going to put it on pause? Jog on. Serious money is resting on this. And so I'm afraid I am very pessimistic because of the dollar signs in everybody's eyes that serious regulation is going to happen. And I fear that there's going to be this continuing arms race because there is so much money at stake.
But John, that's a pretty bleak picture of it, I would say. I mean, you know, stating the obvious a little bit there. But as it not that I disagree with your assessment there, but I think, you know, are there not And this was something I was talking to Jack about before we came on, is it seems to be, and Jack was talking about, say, like medical diagnosis, for example. You're now getting AI-powered diagnosis and analysis of x-rays and things like that that are better statistically than any human could be. So,
yeah, absolutely.
No, you know, are there good sort of outcomes to this as well?
There are some remarkable advances, and they are going to be far more coming. And in particular, a lot of it is just done at the level of the sort of the plumbing. So just improving logistics, improving diagnosis, improving ways of handling data and so on. I think if you think how a company like Amazon works, I mean, it's mind boggling, isn't it? You type in something you want and ping, sometimes same day in London or the following day, there it is. And how often do they completely send the wrong stuff and it gets lost? I mean, it's amazing how accurate and efficient it is. And you compare that with the NHS, you know, the National Health Service, trying to find a result, a blood result, trying to make an appointment with a doctor, I mean, it's light years away. And there's no doubt that using the same kind of efficiencies and technology that Amazon use could make healthcare and many other aspects of society work much more efficiently, much more effectively. But there's this terrible Faustian pact with the devil, because it only works efficiently if you allow all your data to be scraped up so that people can sell advertising. And if we want to have efficiencies, somebody's going to have to pay for it. And unfortunately, it's often the little people who are being abused. It's those who are at the mercy of the manipulation of the big tech companies and their ability to scrape our data and manipulate us. So a lot of work is all done on trying to get you to click. The science of behavior modification, which is going on, they call it social physics. And it's actually a discipline. It's a way of working out how to manipulate you so that you will click in the right places and you'll keep clicking. And it's incredibly effective and incredibly powerful. And it's only going to get more so as these new tools become more sophisticated. So yeah, the ability to manipulate us as human beings is great. Yes, there are going to be wonderful things happening, advances in science and medicine. There's also going to be disruption in so many working practices, offices. Already people who produce copy, for instance, just write text for you know, copywriters and so on, are feeling a very cold wind. I mean, amazingly, even programmers. Yeah. So yeah, these models will also produce endless amounts of code and will write programs and so that people who thought, well, at least I'm a programmer, I'm sort of part of the revolution, might suddenly find actually a lot of those jobs are under threat.
I think that's going to be interesting, though, because as you say about it getting trained on all the sort of hate and bile on the internet, I guess it's also getting trained on every bug and every code base that it's brought in. So it'd be interesting to know how that turns out. But I don't know. I mean, it is fascinating. And I think, you know, to that point around social physics and understanding how to manipulate, I mean, you only have to speak to someone about their, you know, how long they spend scrolling through TikTok to understand that they've got it pretty well dialed in. And the AI behind that of selecting which video to show you next is pretty compelling to keep you looking at that screen. But
I'm going to turn it because I'm just trying to suss out John, because I'm like, okay, you know, what I can tell from John is he's sort the biggest questions, big philosophical, ethical questions, and he's kind of hunted them down. And I just feel like this is so enormous that you're quite enjoying it, John. Like, you're smiling at us now, you're writing a book on this, you enjoy speaking to us about it now, and your head is not in your hands. And so I guess as a Christian, that's what I'm interested in. Just you are enjoying and kind of even speaking about this tonight, you're kind of enjoying it. Whereas some people right now would just be recoiling from this, pulling back from it, just being like, no. And that's what I'd love to dig in. I'd just love to know you, John, a little bit better as a Christian researcher. Why are you digging into this further? Why aren't you recoiling like other people?
It's a really good question. And the truth is, I mean, there are basically two fundamental ways of looking at world history, you know, or the history of the universe or the history of the cosmos. And one is that it's just a random, meaningless progression. You know, somebody said, someone, who was it who said, history is just one damn thing after another. You know, just a meaningless, random, pointless progression. But there's another way of looking at it, and that is that history is actually the unfolding of an absolutely amazing drama, that it's a drama that has a beginning, a middle, and an end. It's a narrative, that it started before the Big Bang, that it's been, this drama has been going on for billions of years, and that it has a direction, it has a meaning. It has a purpose. And, you know, one of the fascinating things about narratives is that the meaning of the narrative is often only revealed in the final chapter. You know, you think of those Agatha Christie whodunits, or, you know, the spy mysteries and so on, and you go all the way through it, you know, John le Carre, whatever it is. It's not until you come to the end that you suddenly go, ah, now I get it. That's the reason he did that. That's the reason she was responding in this way. That was what was going on there. And that's what I believe. And I believe we're in the middle of the most amazing drama. But it's particularly exciting to me because I think the drama is coming to a key point. You know, how long has it taken for the planet to develop, for human beings to develop, for science and technology to develop? All of these things have been going on for aeons and centuries and so on. But now there's some kind of takeoff point when all of this is coming together in some utterly extraordinary way. And I believe it's all part of the drama. It's all part of the narrative. And what we are called to do is to try and understand that we're all bit players in this massive drama. And what I need to do is try and understand what my bit part is within this great drama. I didn't invent this story. I'm a spectator largely, but actually I'm more than a spectator. I'm actually a player, a tiny bit player. And I'm really enjoying it. I'm saying, what a wonderful time to be alive. Wow, amazing for these things to be unfolding in front of our eyes.
Is that because you're relaxed about the ending because you know it, though? So are you saying, because someone could kind of respond to that going, you sound a bit sick, John, because you're saying this is a drama, but do we, you know, is it like an Agatha Christie where everyone just gets murdered, or is it a happy ending? Because that would really change what you're saying, John, because can we sit back and enjoy it and be a part of it? So because you seem quite happy and relaxed, I'm guessing you personally think it's going to end well for you, or
not necessarily for me, to be honest. I think it's possible that it ends badly for me, at least in the short and medium term, as it might end very badly for the whole West. So I'm not Pollyanna-ish in the sense that everything's going to be fine, quit worrying. I am deeply concerned about this confusion between truth and falsehood. About, I wonder, can democracy survive given, you know, democracy depends on a consensus about what the truth is. If we can't even agree on what the truth is, what possible hope is there politically that we're going to survive? So I think that, you know, if you look back on the drama's got some pretty dark places. Look at the Second World War. Look at the Holocaust. Look at Hiroshima. Look at, I don't know what dark places this drama is going to go into in our lifetime. But what I do have a sense is that the ultimate direction of the drama is for good. And that's the difference, because I think that there are a lot of people out there who ultimately believe that this is going to be a tragedy. And it's going to be a tragedy because ultimately there's a super intelligence. These things are going to get to such a state that they're going to take over, and they're going to be no more interested in us than we are interested in microbes or in cockroaches. So that's the kind of dystopic fear, which I don't share. I ultimately believe there is a bigger purpose, a bigger meaning, and ultimately it's going to end in a new heaven and a new earth in which, in some sense, the technology is even going to be incorporated.
So let me just try and summarize summarize this back. Just, so your Christian faith means that you believe there is a super intelligent and also super powerful God that is still in control of this narrative, and it still has a destination. And fundamentally, that is a happy ending in a new heaven and new earth, as the Bible describes, life after death, paradise. But it might still be a bumpy road. And also, you want to be still pointing to the goodness of that super intelligent creator being. And I guess you have a responsibility in your small part, even if it is small, that you are pointing to him as the super designer, not Elon Musk or an artificial computer or anything else.
That's right. What we have to ask ourselves is there some super intelligent mind behind the entire story, number one? And I think the evidence for that is overwhelming. You know, this is not just some kind of random, meaningless events. But two, is that being good? Because that's the question which the modern technologists and scientists are deeply concerned about. They don't have any kind of conviction that whatever is running this show is actually concerned about us and is recognizably good. Many of them would say it's a meaningless question. It's just brute power, it's force, and goodness is a human concept. Whereas actually, I think the Christian idea is to reverse that and say goodness precedes humanity. Goodness is part of the ultimate nature of the being, the mind, the God of the cosmos.
I think probably where I'm landing after this conversation, it's been so interesting, John, kind of getting your insights and hearing some of what you are thinking about. Because to Jack's point, it's clear that you've thought deeply about this and you've sought out those questions. You know, asking the right questions is not trivial, particularly on something as complex as this. And I think that's really, really valuable. But probably where I'm landing is, I think that this is a really fascinating conversation and a really fascinating topic. But it's almost, I think that if you're entering it with either a Christian worldview or a non-Christian worldview, that's going to fundamentally impact how you think about this. You have to almost take a step back and think, well, how do I feel about the outcomes and ramifications of this? If I believe that ultimately a computer could become sentient, could have consciousness to the same degree as I have as a human, well, what does that mean for me as a human? What does that mean about my value? What does that mean about my future? What does that mean about all of the things that we sort of take for granted is pretty fundamental to the human experience of life. And I guess, am I comfortable with that? Because and what I'm trying to get at here is, I think perhaps similarly to you, John, I have a degree of comfort around this because I feel grounded in something deeper, right? Like, this isn't making me question anything fundamental. It's just a really interesting moment to be alive and experience that within the context of how I view the world. But if you don't have that, I could really see this being terrifying quite quickly. That's sort of where I'm landing. It's like one step back from this almost. How do you perceive what's happening here within your sort of worldview? Jack, am I
I think
sense?
So. John?
Well, I would say that I think you're right. And I think there are these two fundamental questions, which every time technology advances, it raises these two fundamental questions. And they are, number one, what does it mean to be human? Because how you respond to that makes all the difference in the world. If in the end we are simply computers made out of meat, which is what one robot expert put it, then that has implications, as you say. And I think actually, as you say, if you really believe that, you've got reason to be really scared, because sooner or later the computers made out of silicon are going to do a whole lot better than computers made out of meat. Crudely.
Yeah.
But the other big question, which is just as important, is what kind of world do we want to build for the future? Because although we can't write the whole story, we are given the dignity of being agents, of actually being able to make a difference. It's interesting, again, that there are these two quite different understandings of what the ideal future would be. You know, what is the end game? Where is all this going? Yeah, what about ChatGPT-5 and then GPT-6? But where's it going? What's the end game? And very few technologists actually think about that. It's just taken for granted that the latest version is going to be more powerful and better and more effective than the previous one. But for many technologists, the end game is a kind of tech heaven where basically you sit on your backside and whatever you want is instantaneously available. Whatever experience you want, whatever, everything is available instantaneously, almost at the speed of thought, just because that's what the technology does. Is that kind of future effortless, frictionless, completely open? Is that kind of future a future where human beings can flourish? Would you want that for your children? I would want to say, actually, no, it isn't. You know, for human beings made out of flesh and blood, we need resistance. We need struggle. We need things to push against. I mean, you're planning to run 26 miles. I mean, you know, what kind of lunacy is that? you could experience it on your backside in virtual reality. I mean, you know, don't put yourself out. So why do you want to match yourself against 26 miles of agony? What is it about what it means to be human, which is something more than just this effortless future?
Come on. Goodness.
Do you know what I think we need, Jack? And I don't know, John, if you can help us with this. I think this has been a really fascinating conversation. I suspect that not everyone has made it this far with us, I would say. The people who have are probably loving it. The people who skipped out 10 or 15 minutes in, I think, are, you know, this is maybe not the one for them. But what would you say to people to go and, if they're interested in this, if they want to unpick this further, where can they go? What can they read? What can they listen to? How can they start to get their heads around this?
I could point in several directions. One is there's a relatively new website called techhuman.org, which is trying to host this kind of conversation between people who have faith and people who don't, and about technology and AI. I have my own website called johnwyatt.com. There's quite a lot of material on there, which is about AI. If you're interested in a book, there's a book called The Robot Will See You Now, which is
about
Christian faith and AI, which I had a part in editing. A whole number of other people wrote chapters in it. But I do think this is just a conversation we all need to be having. I mean, nobody has got some neat, slick answers to all this, but I'm utterly convinced it's really important. And it's, at the moment, most of us are way back in terms of trying to get our heads around it. And yet I think we owe it to one another. We owe it to our children to really start thinking these
things. It's interesting you mentioned that, because we put out on a story, you know, ask John a question. Like, what would you want us to ask John? And one of the questions that came through is, what do we tell our kids? I love that. I think it's a really, I mean, it's a hard question, isn't it? But like, it's such an important one, isn't it? And it goes back to what you just said, John. What sort of world do we want to live in? All right, kids, do you want to just lose yourself in a make-believe world of endless passion, pleasure, and no resistance? And actually just talk about that round the table would be a great start. I'm with you, John. I just think we've got to think about it together and discuss it together with our kids. I'm going to do that as an action point.
Great stuff.
Perfect.
John, you've been brilliant. Like, a few points I didn't think I was going to keep up. I thought I was going to lose it, but you kept us brilliantly and really stretched my thinking in a gentle way. I felt like you were playing with us like two little pups, you know, and and I loved it. Gosh. And I loved it. So thanks, John. I really, really appreciate your time.
Ah, it's a privilege. It's been a good conversation, and let's do it again sometime.
Thanks. We'll take you up on that.
Thanks, John.
Bye.